Okay, we want to welcome you again to a study in Samuel. We're here at the hospital, as we have done so many times and so many years past. And today we are looking at 1 Samuel 19. And you'll recall last week where David had found that Saul's son has great love for David. We found out that Saul was afraid of David, even more so, because Saul knew that the Lord was with David and that the Lord had removed himself from Saul. And so Saul's mind became more suspicious, and with more suspicions, he became more jealous. And because jealousy found a home, envy was the result. And we talked about this last week, but just as a little refresher, we have to remember where we place our minds, what we let our thoughts center on, because when a fleeting moment of jealousy is no big deal, because we've all felt that. But when we let it settle in our minds and in our hearts, and we begin to think about it and chew on it, then pretty soon envy comes. And envy and jealousy are horrible masters. And we will find in Saul that the jealousy and envy that he found and thought and felt toward David becomes murderous. Not just an intention, but in actuality, he tries to kill the man that has so blessed him, Saul. And so now David is the son-in-law of Saul. We find that, and it's kind of funny, ironic, that David is loved by Jonathan, Saul's son, King Saul's son. He's loved by Saul's daughter, Michal. He's loved by the people. He's loved by Saul's servants. And this man is being blessed by the Lord. In this chapter, we are going to see God's restraining power. How man plans and God can restrain or not restrain evil. We're going to see God's restraining grace, his restraining power. And so David is in the court. He is son-in-law to the king. Everybody loves him. So now his life is going to be happy ever after, just like a child's fairy tale, right? Wrong. From this point in the story, David will be pursued. He will be chased. He will be lied about. He will be tormented. He will hide in caves. He will be hungry. He will be despairing. He will be crushed. And this is the man after God's own heart. And this is the man that God has chosen to be king. Oh my goodness, and all these things are going to happen to him? Yeah. And from this point in the story forward, David will enter the school of suffering. And he will learn much about leading God's people through suffering. Most of us do not learn well when things are good and happy. We learn to depend upon the Lord. We learn to trust in His Word when things are not well in our lives. And so many of us have entered the school of suffering. Many of you listening to this on the web know that you have learned much more in the school of suffering than you have in pleasures and fun times and happy times. So we should not look at our lives as we're going to live happily ever after. And if things are good, oh, they're going to stay this way, because they just may not stay this way. Why should we be exempt from the problems, oh, say that David had, or that Job had, or that Isaiah or Jeremiah or Mary, you know, anyone in the Bible, why should we be exempt? They weren't. And yet, we can have that expectation that our lives should be without sorrow and without pain. And that's a wrong expectation. I love Ecclesiastes, and one of the verses says, consider what God has done. When times are good, we'll be happy. And when times are not, when times are bad, Consider this, that God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, man cannot determine or find out anything about his future. We simply don't know. And we better have a relationship with the Lord God, because that will get us through the sufferings of our lives, today and the tomorrows. And that which has not touched our own heart and our own life will touch our heart and life through other people who have gone through sorrows and through sadnesses. So David has not reached the utopian happiness that we might expect. God's going to send him through a school of suffering. He will learn much, and this is not going to be a fast course. This is going to be anywhere from 10 to 13 years that David will be in this type of situation. Let's read chapter 19, verse 1, and it reads thusly. And again, we're in NIV. That's what all the folks have on their table right in front of them. We're all reading, so grab your Bible and read with us if you can. Verse 1. Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants, that is his servants, to kill David. But Jonathan was very fond of David. And can you imagine? Jonathan delighted greatly. That is, that word delighted means it describes laughter, enjoyment, or pleasure. He had lots of things in common with David. He enjoyed his company, and his father, the king, says, "Look, I want you to go that they should kill David, that is Jonathan and all the servants." And so now, what is Jonathan going to do? And remember, Jonathan is heir apparent. He is next in line. It's like if we look at England today, they have a queen, Queen Elizabeth, but the heir apparent would be Prince Charles. And so if something happens to the queen, then Prince Charles would become king. He would be crowned king. Same thing with Jonathan. He would become king. And so it would be to his advantage, yes, to get rid of David, because David's gaining more power. People love him. Everywhere he goes, he succeeds. He's a great warrior, and he has great military campaigns. So it'd be to Jonathan's benefit to get rid of him. What's Jonathan going to do? We'll finish that. But Jonathan was very fond or delighted in David and warned him, quote, "My father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard. Tomorrow morning, go into hiding and stay there." And he says, I will go out and stand with my father in the field where you are. I'll speak to him about you and will tell you what I find out." Boy, that's faithful. There's a wonderful proverb, and it's Proverbs 20, verse 6. And it reads, most every man will say he's good. I've done a lot of study and counseling and et cetera. I've seen surveys where a survey is taken in penitentiaries or in prisons, jails. How does this man feel about himself? This person that's been convicted of a crime, how does he feel about himself? And everyone will say, "Well, I'm a good person. I'm a good person. Yeah, well, I did that crime, but I didn't do what he did. I'm a good person. I'm basically a good person." And that's what Proverbs is saying. Most everybody will proclaim their goodness, but who can find a faithful friend? That is somebody that will go through it with you. Anybody can say, "Oh yes, I'm your friend," but when the tough times come, they scoot, or if it's to their advantage, they side with the other. Aside, who can find a faithful friend? We think of Christ. Every disciple said, "Oh, we're ready to die for you. We'll do whatever happens to you will happen to us. We're going to be faithful." And what did the Lord tell Peter? The spirit's willing, but the flesh is weak. And so we look at Christ, and who was his faithful friend? He had none on this earth. God was always with them, except for the point of when Christ took every sin upon himself. But other than that particular incident, he was not left alone. And that's the way our lives are very many times, is that people can forsake us, and yet they can say, oh, we're your friend for life, we love you, blah, blah, blah. But Jonathan proves that he is a faithful friend. So he goes out and he says, I'm going to ask my dad. You know how much courage that took? Jonathan's already been in a situation where his father was willing to kill him for eating honey. Remember that story? So, I mean, boy, you don't cross King Saul. And everybody knows he's a madman. So Jonathan put his life on the line. Let's see what happens. Verse 4, Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, let not the king do wrong, that is sin, against his servant David, who has not sinned or wronged you, and what he has done has benefited you greatly. He took his life in his hands when he killed the Philistine. The Lord won a great victory for all Israel. You saw it and you were glad, you delighted in that. Why then would you do wrong, that is sin, against an innocent man like David by killing him for no reason? Jonathan has a great testimony here. He says, remember the Philistine, Dad, and how David put his life in his own hands? That's an interesting, I'm told in the Hebrew that it means the palm or the hollow of his hands as a receptacle and not as an instrument. David, it was like David opened his palms and put his very own life in his hands and was willing to give his life up for Saul as king, for God as honor. He wasn't thinking of himself. He opened up his palms. And I want to tell you, I've thought a lot about this week. You want to give something to the Lord, there really isn't anything you can give him except if you just open your hands and open them up as a receptacle. That's all you can do. You can only put your life, your heart, your eternity. That's all you can give to the Lord. That's all you can give. What can you give? David says, what can I give to the Lord for all his benefits to me? What can you give him? Nothing except your will, your love, your all. That's all. And that's what David did. He opened his palms for Israel, for God, for Saul the king. He put his life in his own hands, David said. I mean, Jonathan said. So why are you trying to kill him? Was there laws against killing an innocent man? You better bet your booties. There was laws against killing. Did Saul know them? Sure. Jonathan had a great testimony to remind his father that it was the Lord really who fought for Israel. It was the Lord really who only used David as an instrument, who killed the Philistine. So why is Saul trying to kill him? Well, let's see if it got to him, if he changed his mind. So, verse 6, Saul listened to Jonathan and took this oath. As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death. So this man takes an oath. As the Lord lives, he says. But you know, we've seen this before where Saul says, he uses God's name, he takes oaths, but he doesn't mean it. It's an irreverent use of God's name, of taking an oath in vain, because we're going to find out Saul didn't mean that at all. He only meant it for time, that moment. And remember, we said last week, Saul's every concern was, what does it mean to me? How will this situation affect me? What is it going to do to me? That was his every thought. We have a saying these days, you may have heard it, familiarity breeds contempt. Familiarity breeds contempt. And what it means is that once a person gets real familiar with you, if they're not careful, it can turn into contempt. The same way with irreverent familiarity with the God who made us. We get too irreverently familiar with him, and it's one step away from contempt. Yesterday, I went to had a short road trip. We're in a hospital, so we're sorry. That's an announcement. We'll keep on keeping on. Yesterday, I had a short road trip, and on my way, I listened to Christian radio, which I don't get to do very often because I'm not in one place that long. I don't know who the man was, but he was a preacher, and he was talking about anger and how we can hide anger in our hearts, and we can. But he really messed up because he used Job as an example of and what this preacher called repressed anger. Repressed anger is not a biblical concept. In this, that sense, it's psychological the way he used it. And so my old counselor ears perked up and I thought, well, how is he going to answer? How is he going to use this with Job, for goodness sake? And so he said, remember, you know, Job lost his children and lost his house and lost his animals. And, you know, he had all these problems and his health was taken away and blah, blah, blah. And he said, and then Job said, and he mocked, blessed be the name of the Lord. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I was appalled because I don't believe that Job said that with a junk inside of his heart. I really believe that he meant it. God did not charge Job with saying wrong things about him. God charged Job's friends for saying wrong things about God himself. And see, and this preacher went on, he says, well, now I couldn't do that. And he said, you know, Job had repressed anger, and you know, we can ask, why did God do this? And the anger we can express to God and all these things, that's irreverent, if I said that right, familiarity, because it's one step away from contempt. And so the man yesterday I was listening to, in my opinion, it was contemptuous, because God did not charge Job with wrongdoing, of saying wrong things about him. And this man decided to sit in judgment on Job. And so we can be irreverent and not really think through what we're saying. But I'll tell you, if I err, I want to err on the side of the Lord and make him bigger and better and more faithful, because I don't want to give man any of my exaltation. I want to exalt God, and I don't want to be familiar with God in the sense of being irreverent. I want to know him, but I want to see that there's a divine distance. He's in heaven and I'm on earth, Ecclesiastes says, so let our words be few. Oh, but did Saul do that? No, he did not. He had no problems with taking an oath that he did not mean. And let's see what happens. Verse 7, so Jonathan called David and told him the whole conversation. He brought him to Saul, and David was with Saul as before. Verse 8, once more war broke out. David went out, fought the Philistines. He struck them with such force that they fled before him. Verse 9, but an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand while David was playing the harp. So look, David's back with Saul. He's taken an oath. Jonathan believes his dad that he's not going to try and kill him. And war breaks out. Saul sits at home sulking about David. David goes out to fight the king's battles. David wins victory after victory. We know why, because the Lord is with him. But there's an evil spirit from the Lord. And so here David is playing the harp. He's got a harp in his hand. Saul has a spear in his hand. And what happens? Well, let's see. I'm still here. I lost my place, so hang on with me. verse 10, Saul tried to pin him to the wall with his spear, but David eluded him as Saul drove the spear into the wall. That night, David made good his escape. He fled. He fled from Saul. And from this point on, we're going to see, and we've seen this before, but we're really going to see it now, the invisible hand of God restraining evil from touching David. Saul will not be able to kill him. God will protect him. Is he going to go through the school of suffering? Oh, yes. Very much so. But from that, he will learn to trust God even more. And he fled. You know, very often, now we have Sergeant Major, military Marine here with us. He's been in many, many battles. He could tell you a story that will curl your hair. What he's seen and what he's had to do in his life. But I would think that when you're in a battle, when you're in a war, and specifically with David as we're looking, David understands that Saul has got problems. Now, when something like this happens, and David has never run away from a fight, ever. We remember he didn't run away from the bear. He didn't run away from the lion. He protected those sheep that were in his care. He didn't run away from Goliath. He offered his hands. He offered his life up. And now, all of a sudden, Saul is going to try to take his life again, and he flees. And sometimes it takes more courage to walk away, to flee from a situation, than it does to stand up and fight at that moment for something. It's better sometimes to be thought a coward, to be talked about, even though it's not true. And we're going to find out that David has been lied against again. But sometimes it's better, not easier, because a courageous man finds it difficult to walk away from something like this. But sometimes there's no choice. You know why? Because God's honor is at stake. And David's not going to fight for something that is not his until the Lord wants him to have it. And David's going to walk away from it. He's going to leave it in the hands of God. And very often our lives are that way. It would be easier to stand up and fight. It's harder to walk away, but it's more courageous. Sometimes duty demands that we walk away and leave it in the hands of God, because God surely knows what's going on and the outcome that he has designed. And so it's better to bring about dishonor to the man than to bring dishonor to the Lord God. And so sometimes that happens, but it's not an easy thing for a courageous, valiant man to walk away, because of it's better, it's more honorable to the Lord to walk away and not fight. So he flees. Verse 11, Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and to kill him in the morning. Oh my goodness. You know, but Michal, David's wife, warned him, if you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed. And so again, Saul has the audacity. See, he just took an oath in God's name. He didn't mean it. Because now he sends his servants to stand by David's door and make sure they kill him in the morning. Why didn't they kill him at night? I don't know. It doesn't say. But if you've ever been pitch black dark, you don't know who you're touching, who you're killing. They might have thought, Saul might have thought, well, David might escape. So just stand by the door and make sure he does not escape, and then kill him the next morning. Psalm 59, David wrote about this experience, and he writes in Psalm 59, deliver me from my enemies, O God. Defend me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from the workers of iniquity. Save me from bloodthirsty men. For look, they lie in wait for my life. The mighty gather about me. Not for my sin, not for my transgression, O Lord, that is the covenant God. They run and they prepare themselves, or they are ready to kill me through no fault of mine. And David goes on to say, but I will sing of your power. David knows that God will save him. Yes, I will sing aloud of your mercy in the morning. For you have been my defense and refuge in the day of my trouble. To you, O my strength, I will sing praises. For God is my defense, for my God, my God of mercy. That's Psalm 59, part of Psalm 59. David wrote David went through the school of suffering. We have many of his psalms that he pours out his heart to the Lord because the Lord is his strength. And so Michael warns him. Everything that Saul does backfires. Jonathan didn't kill him. Jonathan warns David. His messengers didn't kill him. Now Michael, his wife, David's wife, the daughter-in-law of Saul, warns him. Verse 12, so Michael let David down through a window. He fled and escaped. And then Michael took an idol. Oh my goodness, David's wife had an idol. And she laid it on the bed, covering it with a garment and putting some goat's hair on its head. Do you think David knew that this idol was in his home? I just don't believe so, because David was not an idolater. Never once has David ever, in this scripture, ever been accused of being an idolater or holding on to little household gods. So here we find something. There's a problem in their marriage. They share the same house. They share the same bed. They probably eat at the same table. But oh my goodness, they do not share the same God. Saul's daughter, Michael, has an idol that she has kept. She does not share David's God. Verse 14, when Saul sent the men to capture David, Michael said, he's ill. So she lies. Verse 15, and then Saul sent the men back to see David and told them, bring him up to me in his bed so that I may kill him. Can you believe that? What a streak of savage cruelty that Saul had, that he was willing to drag a sick man out of his bed and to kill him. Now, this could have been an illness in which David would die from. Saul didn't know, but he wasn't willing to wait. Saul wanted David dead, and he was willing to bring a sick man up and kill him. David is in extreme danger right now, which is only intensifies God's protection of him, because God has the power to restrain evil from touching his David. So let's see what happens. Oh my goodness, verse 16, but when the men entered, there was the idol on the bed. At the head was some goat's hair. So now Michael, Saul's daughter's in trouble. What's she going to do? Verse 17, and Saul said to Michael, why did you deceive me like this and send my enemy away? So he escaped. And Michael told him, he said to me, let me get away. Why should I kill you? She lied to her father. She lied to she lied about David. You know, Saul accused Michael, his daughter, of deceiving him. We have a saying, talk about the pot calling the kettle black, you know. Saul was a master deceiver. He was a master manipulator. He was a master liar. Well, his daughter has learned his habits. Now, there's more problems with Michael. We see what's really in her heart. Michael saves David's life. She was the human agent or the instrument that God in his sovereignty used to save David's life. She did not share his God because she had idols. She did not share his exile. She didn't say, look, David, wherever you go, I'm going. I'm jumping out of this window with you. Nothing's going to happen to you that I'm not going to share. I'm your wife and I love you. She did not. She stayed in the comfy palace. She did not share his exile. And she had regard for his life, but she had no regard for his honor. Do you think that David, we know a lot about David. Do you think that David would actually tell a woman, his wife, let me go or I will kill you? No way. We know more about David's honor and integrity just thus far than to know that he would not say that to his wife. And so she had regard for his life, but not for his honor. She was willing to lie about him. So let's see what happens. Verse 18, when David had fled and made his escape, he went to Samuel at Ramah. Did I say it right? Sergeant Major, did I say that right? And told him all that Saul had done to him. And then he and Samuel went to
Naioth.
Tell me again.
Naioth.
Naioth, thank you, at Ramah. And so he sent men to capture him. Let's stop at verse 19. So David flees. We haven't heard anything about Samuel for a long time now, you know. But Saul's still working for the Lord. And he understands. Who could David have fled to that would have been more help to him spiritually and physically? Does Samuel know what's going on with Saul? Sure. Does Samuel understand? Samuel understands far more than David does about Saul. Because remember, God told Samuel, I'm done with Saul. I'm finished with Saul. David knew a little bit, but Samuel knew more. Saul is Samuel's enemy. Saul has gone back, and he surrounds himself with these. We'll find that this is this place is a little village in the Ramah area, Saul's home, Samuel's hometown, and it's dwelling places. It's houses where the pupils or students of the prophet Samuel learn. There's a school there, and Samuel is the teacher. And so he surrounded himself, and I guess maybe he felt safer there. But David flees to Samuel. Isn't it nice how things in our lives are not all that pleasant, and God will place someone in our lives to encourage us, to help us, maybe even help us financially to get through? God is tremendous. We don't see His invisible hand. We only see the results of His blessing. And this is what He's done for David. He has Samuel. They can talk to each other. They can share their concerns. David can be refreshed, encouraged by Samuel. How gracious of God. We can see how God provides and restrains evil from David. We can see God's restraining power in this passage. So let's see, where are we? Verse 20. And so he sent men, that is Saul, sent men to capture him, David. But when they saw a group of prophets prophesying with Samuel standing there as their leader, the Spirit of God came upon Saul's men, and they also prophesied. Oh my goodness. They saw these men. They were singing praises. They were talking about the Lord. And all of a sudden, these men, these servants of Saul, started prophesying along with the prophets. Oh my goodness, it's backfired again on Saul. See, God can do anything. There is nothing impossible with God. And so, verse 21, Saul was told about it, and he sent more men, and they prophesied too. And Saul sent men a third time, and they also prophesied. Well, finally, can you just imagine his frustration? He probably was so angry, and he said, what's wrong with these people? They're my servants. You know, they're supposed to go kill David. Can you imagine his frustration? Finally, verse 22, he himself left for Ramah, and when he and went to the great cistern at Sakeu, thank you, Sergeant Major, and he asked, where are Samuel and David? And they answered over at
Naamah.
Thank you, at Ramah, they said, in verse 23. And so they, Saul went to
Naioth.
Okay. See, listen, this keeps me humble. And the Lord has placed Sergeant Major in my life just to help me get through these rough times. So see how God works. So Saul went to this little village, but the Spirit of God came even upon him. And he walked along prophesying until he came to
Naioth.
Thank you. He stripped off his robes, and he also prophesied in Samuel's presence. He lay that way all that day and night. And this is why people say, is Saul also among the prophets? And this became kind of a saying. And he didn't lie naked. The Israelites had a real problem with nakedness in public, in the public, and so it meant that he took off his royal robes. He kind of had his clothes underneath, or his shell, or whatever it was. But he wasn't just nude laying out. God's Spirit can do whatever God sends it to do. All things serve God's purpose. All things. And so we have a symbolic picture. Saul lays aside his royal robe. And guess what? He lays that way all that day and all that night. See, God is allowing David to put lots of distance between himself and the madman Saul. God restrains evil. God can do anything. It's real interesting. Someone said, an old author from a book that I have from the 1800s, and on this verse, he said, and I quote, "Let not the worst be despaired of, yet let not the external show of great devotion or sudden change for the present be too much relied on. For Saul among the prophets was Saul still." And so what he's saying is that if someone has a character, and this is their character, and you know what their character is, and yet if they flip-flop and go, "Oh, I'm sorry," and, "Oh, you know, this happened and that happened, and oh, please forgive me," don't count on it. Don't count on it. Remember that Saul prophesied, but Saul was still Saul. And so this little momentary lapse into something other than meanness was a direct of God's working on Saul, gave David time to escape, gave him all that day, all that night, and David was long gone when Saul got himself up. You see, really and truly, each individual, each child of God is immortal until his work is done. I love Acts 13:36. If you know me, you know I love that verse. And it reads, "And when David had served God's purpose in his own generation, he went to sleep." And it continues on about his body decayed, but Christ did not decay. It came out of the grave. I love the last part of that verse, but I particularly like the first part too, because it reminds me that you, I, a child of God, we are immortal until our work is finished. And when our work is finished, we go home. And I don't care if we're young, old, in the middle, or whatever. When God says, "You've done what I've called you to do, your job is finished, your hard labor's done, come home," we will go home. And I like that. And so we find that David's, or at least Samuel's first encounter with Saul, it is, he encounters, sorry, let me get my thoughts straight here. Saul is used by the Spirit of God. He's prophesying. That's the last encounter that he will have with the Spirit of God. The first time we saw Saul, he and his encounter with Samuel, remember when Samuel anointed him, he went down the hill and he began prophesying with the prophets. Those are brackets to his life. That's our first meeting with Saul. This is our last meeting with Saul and the Spirit of God in a beneficial way. And so it kind of brackets. He continues, Saul will continue to stumble to his doom. And his doom is, his life is sealed because he rejected God. Self-will, self-motivated, don't want God in my life. I'm going to do what I want to do. And he will do that to his detriment. And so we are come to the end of this chapter. We've got to run. We're just a tad over. We appreciate you listening. It's hard to think biblically, but look, we are not exempt. A Christian is not exempt from the sorrows of life. And, you know, James says, count it all joy when you encounter trials. Why? Because it's going to do something for you. God's working in your life, and we need to remember to count it all joy. We don't have to say, oh, doesn't this feel good? Please give me some more. But it means, Lord, work in my life. Use whatever you've brought into my life to bring me up to snuff in your eyes. Get the junk out of my life that's unnecessary in my life, that does not please you. And so we need to remember to ask the right questions, not sit around and cry about what's happening in our life. And it's okay to cry about what's happening in our life. We read the Psalms. David cries out his eyes to the Lord. And so David has now entered the school of suffering, in which he will stay as a student for 10 to 13 years. That's a long time to suffer. God knows what he's doing, and David implicitly trusts the Lord. May we do the same. This is Dr. Lacey Couch for Thinking Biblically. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.